Welcome to KWVB 105.5. Today I'm sitting with David Hockey and Jacob Prash. We are both, all three of us, attending a prophecy conference in the Palm Desert area with Ohav Shalom. David and Jacob, it's a pleasure to have you here with us today.
Thank you. Wonderful to be with you, Dan.
Yes, and we're at a prophecy conference speaking about the last days, and of course, Israel seems to be the focal point of the conference. I'll start with you, David. You talked last night about this being the last days. Can you explain why you feel that is the case?
Well, I don't think there's any question about it if you follow the biblical plan. It appears that when Peter preached on the day of Pentecost in Acts 2, he quoted Joel, and he said, in the last days. We have also a statement in Hebrews chapter 1 that God spoke in times past to the prophets, to the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son. Some say in the last of these days, that's the way it reads in the Greek, which means the days in which God spoke. In other words, his final revelation would be the person of the Messiah. But the last days also cover such a lengthy period of time, people wonder, well, how close are we to the end of that period of time? It appears that the last days will go through the tribulation, which is called the day of the Lord, the last portion of it, the time of Jacob's trouble, which Jacob spoke so beautifully about last night.
Yes.
And then at the end of that, the Messiah returns. And we also know that is a point of time that ends the last days, as Israel will look on him when they pierced. So we are in the last days. The question is, where are we in that? We know that Paul spoke, as I mentioned last night, that perilous times will come in the last days. And he seems to focus that on the end of that period of time. So we're already over 1900 years. So that's just a little synopsis. But we believe we're at the conclusion of that. And we're seeing God's prophetic plan being wrapped up, really. And a lot of that relates, of course, to Israel and what's happening there.
And Jacob, David had mentioned the time of Jacob's trouble. And you did speak about that last night. And can you go ahead and talk a little bit about what that time is and how we can associate that with the last days?
The scriptures speak of Israel making a covenant with death, an actual covenant with death. The culmination of this will be a false treaty made or broken by the Antichrist, and I have no doubt that the things we see transpiring now in the political realm, internationally and diplomatically, we're setting the stage for this idea of a quest for a Middle East peace that will ultimately prove to be a false peace. There'll be no true and lasting peace until Jesus comes, but this counterfeit peace is described as a covenant with death. The time of Jacob's trouble are the ramifications of it. Hatekufat Hatzarat Yaakov, the time of Jacob's trouble. It essentially transpires during the 70th week of Daniel's vision, or the last 7 lunar years of history, is when it really reaches its apex, or its absolute climax. This particular period is something that unbelieving Israel will go through totally, but the church will be taken out of or away from. But unbelieving Israel will essentially go through it. And had the Messiah not returned to bring a final salvation, no human flesh would be saved, and certainly no Jew would be saved. In fact, we're told in Zechariah, during this period, 2/3 of the Jewish population that have been regathered to Israel and Jerusalem are going to be wiped out. Terrible things are going to happen in the Middle East, a number of very terrible things. And while my own family are Israeli, I have a son in the Israeli military as we speak. My children are born in Galilee, and I have a tremendous love for Israel, and I realize what God is doing. I also realize the stage is being set for something terrible. The advent of Antichrist will come, Israel will be deceived, and no device of man is going to prevent from happening what has to happen. Jerusalem is where Satan got his biggest defeat, and it's where he will get his final defeat. He knows the time is short. We see battles transpiring in the spiritual realm. In the book of Daniel, Daniel shows us that Middle East events are simply a reflection of conflicts in the heavenlies. Well, I have no doubt that what we're seeing now is essentially what Daniel saw happening. He saw these conflicts in the Middle East between what we call in English principalities, from the Greek arche, from the Hebrew rashi ot. these conflicts with spiritual forces in the heavenlies that have ramifications on the earth, particularly the Middle East politically. Well, Daniel chapter 10 is certainly well underway. Daniel 11 is coming. Daniel 12 will ultimately be the final climax. But without doubt, I would have to echo David Hawking's views that these times are already commencing before us. When we'll be into that 7-year period, I don't know. But without any doubt, we are heading for it full steam.
Thank you, Jacob. In my estimation, we could be in the final century, and the signs seem apparent about that. You know, David, with America these days, and again, now Hillary Clinton has gone over and is advocating to carry on with a two-state solution and dividing Jerusalem. And I was also recently at a prophecy conference where you spoke in Chino Hills about Benjamin Netanyahu and some of the things he's trying to implement. For instance, people will need to go back to the Bible and in the Knesset.
Well, he's having a lot of trouble because you really have to have a coalition government to run the government in Israel. It's a little different system than we have, of course, here. But he's got 68 of what Israel calls right-wingers, basically people that don't want to give up anything anymore. And people say, well, that's more than half. But it's not quite enough to get a lot of legislation passed. So he's working very, very hard. There are some who believe that Ehud Barak, the current Minister of Defense, will join his government. He has requested that, interestingly, just in the last 2 days. So there is a shift going on. And I believe he has, Jacob, another week to put this together?
Yes, he has.
Yeah, he has to, or else we're going to have more trouble. So the Obama administration, and being represented by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at the present time, tried to exercise a little bit more leadership at the conference in Sharm el-Sheikh this week. Hillary said that the Obama administration would give $900 million, $600 million to Fatah, $300 million to Gaza, and that it wouldn't go through Hamas or Hezbollah. Well, that's a bunch of nonsense. Mm. The point is, they were pledging money like crazy. There are 80 leaders there. And at the same time this is going on, we have the counter-conference in Tehran, which is calling for the death of Israel. And we got people there also. Israel allowed the leader of Hamas, who lives in Damascus, to go to Egypt, thinking he's going to Sharm el-Sheikh. He did not. He got on a plane and flew to Tehran and was the main speaker. I'm telling you, what we have happening here is a lot of deceit, a lot of manipulation, and Mr. Netanyahu is not liked by any Middle East leader. Primarily, you know, he wrote a great book on terrorism. He's of course, American educated. And he is well liked by evangelicals who are interested in prophecy. But it remains to be seen what's going to happen. He made a statement day before yesterday that bothered me, for instance. He was willing to give up part of the Golan. I don't think you give him an inch. But he knows that Damascus is up to no good. So what's going to happen? I don't know. The Obama administration has made it clear they believe in negotiating with Israel's enemies. But we learn in the Bible, don't we, in Nehemiah, when they asked him to negotiate, they said, let's go out to the plain of Ono and we'll talk. And he said, oh, no. Right.
Well,
but it's a dangerous time, and it's a confusing time. You know, I watch this every day, and I'm telling you, anybody that says they know exactly what's going to happen is crazy. The Lord God of Israel knows what's going to happen, but the particulars that we're going through now are very troubling, very troubling.
Absolutely, David. You know, and Jacob, you and I were talking earlier about a prophecy. David mentioned Damascus. Well, there's a very important prophecy in Isaiah 17:1 that talks about the destruction of Damascus, and you were telling me that the Hebrew word, I'd like you to talk about that, and then also dovetail into talking about you know, Genesis 12:3 is on the mind of many evangelical Christians, especially American evangelical Christians, and we're very concerned, they're very concerned, that perhaps America's policy toward Israel, like David was just specifying, is actually not blessing Israel at this point. It tends to be cursing and forcing them to negotiate with those that don't even want them to exist. So can you talk about this Isaiah 17:1 Damascus prophecy, and then also talk about your thoughts on America and Genesis 12:3 with Israel?
Well, concerning the Damascus prophecy, obviously there's been no historical fulfillment. The city must be obliterated, and it's never historically happened. It's been conquered, but never obliterated. There has to be a fulfillment of that prophecy at some point, because it's never happened. Damascus is aligned closely with Iran, which is very strange. It is a political alliance. It is not a religious one, because the Muslims in Syria, at least the controlling faction of the Assad government, are Alewa, while the Shias are the controlling faction in Iran. They have very, very disparate interpretations of Islam. In fact, would even consider each other to be heretical. It's an alliance of convenience. So what you see happening in the United States and with its European allies, and to a degree with Israel, is an attempt to uncouple Syria from Iran, and of course Israel will be the bargaining chip to make concessions to achieve that end. Mm-hmm. American Middle East policy has always been viewed as part of a general overall scenario in global power plays. For instance, going back to 1967, American support for Israel in the late 60s and in the early 70s through the Yom Kippur War was very much part and parcel of the Cold War. The Soviets were backing Syria and Egypt, so therefore America backed Israel. It was always a sideshow. It was always a sideshow in Western politics. In World War I, it was the same with the British. What General Allenby did with the Turks was a sideshow of the fact that Turkey was aligned with Germany. The Middle East has always been viewed as a sideshow in Western politics and diplomacy, by the British, by the French, by the Americans, by the Russians, and so forth. But biblically, it's not a sideshow. It's central. And that's one of the things that people in Washington and London and so forth fail to realize. It's not a sideshow. It's not ancillary to other events. It's central to events. That's the first problem you have. The second problem you have is Israel's vulnerability economically and politically. Even a right-wing government in Israel will be limited in its capacity to exercise territorial sovereignty or even its own long-term defense policies by political pressure internationally, particularly from the European Union economically, which is Israel's chief export market for agricultural produce, but also from its reliance on American technology, defense support, and economic aid. Israel can always be pressured. Now, just look at what's happened. Two administrations, both of them Republican, George H. Bush and George W. Bush. It was George H. Bush, Bush Sr., with James D. Baker in 1991, that essentially took southern Lebanon, pressing for an Israeli withdrawal, took southern Lebanon and handed it on a silver platter to Syria, aligned with Iran, creating a Hezbollah territorial entity to attack Galilee again in 2006. Land for peace did not work, but the Republicans pressured Israel out. Well, what was his agenda? What was the motive of Baker and Bush for doing it? Quite simply, Carlyle Group, Saudi oil, their partnership with Saudi Arabia. Placate the Saudis by all means, Israel be damned, even America be damned. They pursued things to placate the Saudi Arabians that were plainly not in the national interest of America. It may have been in the interest of multinational oil interests or banking interests, but not of America. His son, George W., did the same thing with Condoleezza Rice. They created an Iranian-controlled terrorist territorial entity, de facto state, in Gaza.
Hamas,
though. Hamas. In Lebanon, it was Hezbollah. In Gaza, it was Hamas. Land for peace didn't work. Now, Israel had no peace treaty, no guarantees. Just get out. Just give up the land. Who said so? Well, the White House. President Bush. Why? Saudi Arabians want them to. This has been consistent policy of the American government, both Democrat and Republican, both parties, going back to the 1970s. This placation of the Saudis as if they like us, as if they're our friends. It was also mentioned Fatah. This $900 million. This country is essentially broke. We're putting another $900 million on the taxpayers' credit card to give money to people who hate us. A, there is no way some of that money will not wind up under the control of Hamas. It's an impossibility. It is a practical, logistical impossibility. Secondly, Fatah is not the good guys. They're not the good guys. They're misrepresented to be by people like Condoleezza Rice or now by Hillary Clinton. Never have been. The Al-Aqsa Brigade, which is the terrorist branch of Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, are just as ruthless. They're just as murderous. They're just as treacherous, just as fanatical in their interpretation of Islam, just as jihadist as Hezbollah or Hamas. They're not the good guys. It is not even a coherent, unified power base in itself. It has factions that Abbas can't control. The whole thing comes down to this wrong view. Western powers always look at Israel, the Middle East, as a sideshow to global geopolitics. That's not the situation at all. It is central. But unfortunately, because we have biblically illiterate politicians, and because we have the State Department that is very much Council of Foreign Relations, very much into the globalist mindset, very much into this general scheme of redefining economy and political structure globally, that predominates all foreign policy. They don't know what they're doing. They're digging themselves in deeper and deeper, and they don't even know what they're dealing with. Yes, they will bring God's judgment on America. I just think when President Bush forced Israel out of Gaza, with the collaboration of Ariel Sharon, no doubt, when it happened without a peace treaty, it was done again to placate Saudi Arabians in large measure. Gulf oil. But there's two oil gulfs in the world. One is the Persian Gulf, the other is the Gulf of Mexico. The next day, after Israelis were forced out of their homes in Gaza, Americans were forced out of their homes in Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana. American oil rigs and American oil drilling platforms in the Gulf were destroyed by a hurricane. I have no doubt this was God's judgment, God's retribution on America, brought on us by our own leaders. I'd also point out that in the aftermath of September 11th, for a full year to September 11th, despite the fact that 18 of the 19 September 11th hijackers were Saudis, George Bush, Condoleezza Rice, continued giving express visas to Saudi Arabians to come into America on an express visa basis. That would be like Roosevelt handing out visas to kamikaze pilots after Pearl Harbor. Why would he do that? Well, it shows you why he would do it. These people don't work for America. They work for multinational banking and corporate interests. The world is in the power of the wicked one.
Well, just reflecting on a couple of your comments, if even a portion of that 300 million of American dollars made its way...
900 million.
900 million.
Yeah. Of which 300 goes to Fatah.
Could go to Fatah.
You know, excuse me, the other way around. To Hamas, 600 million to Fatah.
Yeah, so that would make America, if the math is correct, the second largest funder of Hamas next to Iran, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Second of all, you did talk about the connection of Genesis 12:3. I've heard this before of Hurricane Katrina, America's most costly hurricane in its history. Now, I want to shift thoughts for a second, David, and talk to you. It's interesting, in this financial meltdown that's going on worldwide, of all times, Israel, on the Tamar 1, 80 kilometers off of Haifa, out into the Mediterranean, discovers the largest, and they're realizing it's larger than ever, a deposit of natural gas. And Hal Lindsey has mentioned to me that it's along the same crevasse that Zion Oil is drilling for on the mainland of Israel there. Not that they struck anything of any magnitude there, but I find that fascinating as well. Is God about to restore some fortune into Israel in fulfillment of some Bible prophecies that we might find, like in Deuteronomy 30, verses 1 through 5? What do you think about the timing of this discovery? And could this also segue into the type of Israel, the wealthy Israel, that apparently Russia and Iran come after in Ezekiel 38 and 39? Because they're coming after a wealthy Israel at that point.
Well, I'm not a politically savvy person. I'm just following what I know is in the Bible. But what you just said is a mouthful. First of all, there is a huge oil deposit off of that Ashkelon. Netanyahu pointed this out when he's been the Minister of Finance. But it's too costly for Israel. It would not be wise to spend all that money to get it when the return is not that big. What we have at the natural gas discovery is the biggest natural gas discovery ever in the history of the world. And it's cleaner. I think this is quite significant. It will take Israel some time to extract it. There's a lot to be done here. It's going to take years. But there's enough there not only to take care of Israel for 100 years, but also the United States of America as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something big going to take place. I don't know. When you said about Russia and Iran, that's assuming that is taught in Ezekiel 38 and 39. They appear to be motivated by a financial gain.
Mm.
That could be a part of it.
Mm.
But you have to remember the shekel is now the number one currency in the world in terms of stability. We also have investments by some of the biggest multi-billionaires in the world in Israel that are really paying off big right now. So, you know, how all this fits in is another big question. We also have a problem with Israel herself. She's at a crossroads, and I read this almost every day. The Israeli Mossad tells us what they want to on their site. I mean, they're not telling us everything. But Israel is in a dilemma. They have got to stop Iran's nuclear program.
Hmm.
Iran said this week in the counter conference that they have now. It was not we will have. It was we have now the ability to send a nuclear weapon to Israel and wipe it off the face of the earth. Well, what would we do if that was being threatened from our borders here in the United States? You understand Israel's got a real dilemma now. So you've got all this wealth happening, and that's good. But you also have tremendous expenditures going on in the military area. And how are you going to keep up? Who's going to have the most bombs? Who's going to have the most weapons? But Israel can't sit still and allow even a suitcase nuclear weapon to be shot at any one of their cities. You're talking the death of millions of people. I don't know what's going to happen. All I know is every day they discuss it. And now it's getting worse. The Ayatollah of Iran spoke at that convention. I don't know if you read his message. It was unbelievable. It's probably one of the most serious anti-Israel messages we've heard in a long time. More severe than Ahmadinejad has said, and he's just a puppet of the Ayatollah. But the fact is, Iran is on a mission to gain ascendancy in the Muslim world and to attack Israel and get rid of them. That's what this is all about. Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, Muslim Brotherhood, name them all, even Al-Qaeda. You know, how they all fit together. We know from Psalm 83, they're confederate on one thing, and that's to wipe out Israel, to cut off Israel. They fight among themselves, but they're confederate in destroying Israel. Now, if you were Netanyahu or Barak or anybody else in the government, what would you do? Would you just let this happen? Israel can't afford to do that. Something has got to give, and everybody is saying that every day. But if Israel does it and causes a nuclear confrontation in the Middle East, we're going to have the whole world involved. It's a serious problem.
Jacob.
Sometimes it's not what the media says, but what they don't say that's important, as David pointed out with some of the websites. There are three factors not popularly discussed that are all crucial to understanding what's presently happening in light of biblical prophecy. First of all, Hillary Clinton is purely window dressing. She's not the real voice of the power in the Obama administration concerning Middle East policy. There's two other people. One is Mitchell. Obama is not stupid. He wouldn't trust Hillary Clinton to broker Middle East peace or to broker anything. She's simply political window dressing. She's a political appointment. She doesn't even speak a foreign language. I live in England. You wouldn't find a European country whose foreign minister doesn't speak a foreign language. She's window dressing. She's irrelevant. The two people we need to watch, Mitchell, and the other is Rahm, Israel, Emanuel. His father was a Jabotinskyite, a right-wing Jewish partisan. He's widely alleged to have been the Mossad informant within the Clinton White House, codename MIGA. He's widely believed not to be a Mossad agent, but to be a Mossad, what's called a Scan in Hebrew, Mossad affiliate. He's the real power behind the throne with Obama. I don't think that the Jewish American lobby in the Democratic Party, 78% Jewish support for Obama, would have went that way unless they had some kind of an ace in the hole. They're not completely stupid. Naive, yes, but not completely stupid. Watch him. Watch Emanuel. He, of course, made $16 million in the banking sector. He was on the board of Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae, which is amazing that Obama has appointed the same people to dig us out of the subprime mess that got us into it. Nonetheless, that's another issue. The second factor is, understand Iran. Again, America looks at Israel as a sideshow or as a bargaining chip. You have a fundamental factional rivalry between Sunni and Shia Islam. 1.5 million people were killed in the war between Iran and Iraq back in the 80s. This hatred goes back to the Battle of Karbala in the earliest centuries of Islam. We're talking 7th, 8th centuries. Unbelievable hatred. The Saudi Arabians, the Kuwaitis, the Emirates are petrified of a nuclear-armed Iran. Hence, the Americans are thinking maybe we can use Israel military prowess as our instrument to neutralize Iran and use that somehow to make these moderate Arab states give diplomatic recognition to Israel's right to exist and marginalize Hamas and Hezbollah. That's the second line of thinking. The third line of thinking is the educated middle class of Iran are not anti-Western. Most of them are not even anti-American. Ahmadinejad is in a precarious position with the mullahs. They're not popular people. It is mainly the less educated Persians who are non-Arabs who support the mullahs and support Ahmadinejad's party. What the CIA has been thinking and the State Department is thinking is the way they pushed Pahlavi, the late Shah, into power in the 1950s. Perhaps an internal coup like that can be engineered again. If you have an external attack on Iran, it will unite Iran on back of the mullahs and on back of Ahmadinejad for purely nationalistic, compatriotic, Islamic reasons. They don't want to make any kind of coherent nationalistic Iran. They want to keep it politically and socially and culturally divided. They want to keep it ethnically divided between the Azerbaijanis, the Arabs, and the Persians. They want to keep it ideologically divided between the secular Iranians, secular Persians, and the mullahs. The ideal scenario would be to displace Ahmadinejad internally. Hence, America has been withholding Israel, or withholding itself, from any kind of preemptive attack on Iran. That's the factor. They think there may be a possibility to depose Ahmadinejad internally. That is a lot of their strategic thinking. Now, again, these things are not popularly discussed in the media, but it's what's happening.
Well, and this puts Israel in the most precarious position. I'd like to wind down. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. You both are Messianic Jews. You were Jewish and you believe in Jesus. And take a moment to talk about, to our Jewish audience that may be listening, as well as to Christians, how they may best witness to Jewish people. Because many, many Jews these days are coming to know the Lord. Can you just take a moment to sort of summarize with some thoughts on that, David?
Well, first of all, in terms of skill, knowledge, and background, Jacob's way in another league. I'm not even close. My dad was secular, cigar-smoking, swearing Jew. He was an oil man, and he didn't go to synagogue or anything. We didn't know hardly anything when we grew up. The only thing we knew is that he loved Israel. In 1948, it was clear in our home what the issue was. And he jumped around and screamed and yelled after David Ben-Gurion announced the name of that land was Eretz Israel. But so even people who have known me years ago know that Israel was at the heart of that. Now, I've found, Jacob may have a different line on this, but I found that probably the way to begin in your contacts with Jewish people is with Israel. They have many, many agencies in the Jewish community working in Israel. They're very concerned about Israel. They read about it all the time. They talk about it in the synagogues, and I've spoken in many of their synagogues. So I'm familiar with that. But if you're asking me about strategy, because we've seen a lot of Jewish people come to believe in Yeshua.
Yes.
And I would say the thing we got to stop doing in our witnessing is telling everybody what we believe and what we want them to believe. We need to go to asking questions and respecting their opinions. I get this a lot from our Jewish friends. In other words, if you never ask them, how do you respect them? You're telling them, it's like you're trying to score points on your gospel gun. We need people who really love the Jewish people, number one. Paul said, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they may be saved. He said he had continual sorrow in his heart. Mm. I don't see that. I see a lot of cocky, proud, arrogant Jewish evangelism, both in methods and people. And that isn't my experience. My experience is if you love Jewish people sincerely, and especially if you do nice things for them when it's not their birthday or anniversary, you will have a friend for life. They become very loyal to you. And if you're open and you love to discuss things and allow them to share their own feelings, you will find many more open doors than dumping on them all that you believe as a Christian. So I do urge people, and that's true of Muslims too. You got to show respect. You got to listen to them. And I hate everything Islam represents. But I want the opportunity to get into their hearts with the gospel. And you got to love people, and you've got to ask them questions, and stop being so arrogant. It is very, very important. And I'm finding that a lot of Muslims, as well as Jews, are turning to the Lord. But I don't make a big deal about it, because that also would alienate others whom you're trying to reach if you keep talking about how many people are coming to know the Lord, and there are thousands and all. You know, in Israel, I have seen website after website talk about 10 to 20,000 Jews. You know what the Israeli Messianic movement says? There is maximum 7,000. Mm. Maximum. But you see what I'm talking about now, Bill? Mm-hmm. They exaggerate, like, to make us more important because, boy, our ministry is reaching thousands.
Got it. Yeah.
There's a ministry to Jews in Israel right now that I know of who is telling people they've seen over 10,000 people come to Christ. Well, it's ridiculous. It's not true. So again, a little intellectual honesty here and much more love. If you can't have a broken heart for your Jewish friends, you better go back in the prayer closet and get right with the Lord.
Read Romans 9, 10, and 11.
Yeah.
Put your heart right in there.
Yeah.
And Jacob, a few thoughts from you as well.
What David says is true. There are people who grossly overestimate the numbers of Jews who are being saved and are being saved in Israel. I would estimate, and I'm giving an estimate, of about 6,000 personally. I would say about 6,000, but that's, again, a guesstimate.
Yeah.
However, when I first immigrated to Israel in the 1970s, there was 200. So you're still speaking of exponential growth. I would also point out, you have seen many thousands in Russia and the Ukraine, and you have seen tens of thousands in North America.
Yes.
So it is happening elsewhere, but Israel, it's also happening, but nothing on the magnitudes in the Galut, the diaspora. Concerning reaching Jews, there are two, you have to understand the nature of the objections Jewish people have. They essentially are two things. One, the ugly history of so-called Christian anti-Semitism, and the other is, why didn't Jesus bring in worldwide peace if he was the Messiah? Mm-hmm. This is their thinking. Concerning the first one, it's important, as David said, the solution to anti-Semitism is Philo-Semitism. Gentile Christians have a distinct advantage. Now, I grew up bicultural. I went to a Catholic school and the Jewish Community Center. My family are pure Israeli, Hebrew-speaking, born in Israel, and so forth. I understand the Jewish culture, but I also understand the Gentile culture and the way Gentiles see Jews as well as the way Jews see Gentiles. I'm ambicultural. The situation is, you have to let them see the difference between a Bible-believing Christian and a nominal Christian. The real problem becomes people like John Stott in England who teach against Israel. They teach Christians to be against Israel. You have people in the United States who teach Israel has no prophetic significance, like John Piper. Well, these churches do a lot of harm to the cause of seeing Jewish people saved, and the people who go to these churches are not doing the cause of Christ any good in terms of seeing Jews come to faith. I'm not saying these people aren't Christians or they're not saved, but they're damaging the cause of Jewish evangelism. That is one major problem, and along with it goes the entire issue of replacement theology. You have to let them see the difference between a biblical Christian and a nominal Christian. We didn't do that. These were false Christians who did this. We're not responsible for the Crusades or for the Holocaust. These were nominal Protestants. These were Catholics. They're not our people. You have to let them see that kind of distinction to the degree possible. You also have to let them know, don't blame Jesus for what was done in his name. An Orthodox Jew assassinated Yitzhak Rabin in the name of Moses and the Torah, put a kippah on his head, a yarmulke, and put two bullets into the back of Rabin in the name of the Torah and Moses. I can't blame Moses for what a Jew did in his name. I can't blame Jesus for what Gentiles did in his name. Moses never taught murder, either did Jesus. Let's deal with Moses, let's deal with Jesus. If I was to reject Jesus because of what was done in his name, I'd have to reject Moses for the same reason. Jewish people killed their own prophets, according to the Tanakh, in the name of Moses very often. We can't do that. Let's look what Moses said, let's look at what Jesus said. Secondly, this idea the Messiah is going to bring in worldwide peace, that is true. But Daniel tells us that is not his purpose in his first coming. Daniel 9 tells us that is his purpose in his second coming. It is in his second coming he will bring in worldwide peace. In Judaism, we have two pictures of the Messiah, HaMashiach ben Yosef and HaMashiach ben David, Messiah son of Joseph and Messiah son of David. In his first coming, the Messiah comes in the character of Joseph in Genesis, a suffering servant. In his second coming, he comes in the character of King David, a conquering king. He will bring in worldwide peace, but the Hebrew prophet Daniel and other prophets made it clear that was not his purpose in his first coming. But he will bring in worldwide peace when he returns. Understand the nature of Jewish objections. Christian anti-Semitism and this wrong idea that the Messiah was going to bring worldwide peace in his first coming. Those are the two issues that caused most Jews to reject Jesus, Yeshua.